Then came news that water was falling from a point in Charleston. Several days before, in the News and Courier, had been published the insect explanation of falls of water. In the News and Courier, November 5, a reporter tells that he had visited the place in Charleston, where it was said that water was falling, and that he had seen a fall of water. He had climbed a tree to investigate. He had seen insects. But there are limits to what can be attributed, except by the most desperate explainers, to insects. In the Monthly Weather Review, August, 1886, it is said that, in Charleston, September 4, three showers of hot stones had been reported. An examination of some of these stones, shortly after they had fallen, forced the conviction that the public was being made the victim of a practical joke. How an examination of stones could demonstrate whether they had been slung humorously or not, is more than whatever brains I have can make out. Upon September 4, Charleston was desolate. The great earthquake had occurred upon August 31, and continuing shocks were terrorizing the people. Still, I'd go far from my impressions of what we call existence, if I'd think that terror, or anything else, was ever homogeneous at Charleston, or anywhere else. Battles and shipwrecks, and especially diseases, are materials for humorists, and the fun of funerals never will be exhausted. I don't argue that in the midst of desolation and woe, at Charleston, there were no jokers. I tell a story as I found it recorded in the Charleston News and Courier, September 6, and mention my own conclusion, which is that wherever jocular survivors of the catastrophe may have been cutting up capers, they were not concerned in the series of occurrences. At 2:30 o'clock, morning of September 4, stones, which were found to be warm, fell near the News and Courier building, some of them bounding into the press room. 5 hours later, when there was no darkness to hide mischievous survivors, more stones fell. It was a strictly localized repetition, as if one persisting current of force. At 1:30 o'clock in the afternoon again stones fell, and these were seen, coming straight down from a point overhead. If any conviction was forced, it was forced in the same old way as that in which for ages convictions have been forced, and that is by forcing agreements with prior convictions. Other details were published in the Richmond Whig. It was told that the stones, which were flint pebbles, ranging from the size of a grape to the size of a hen's egg, had fallen upon an area of 75 square feet, and that about a gallon of them had been picked up. In a descriptive narrative of the earthquake of August 31, 1886, Carl McKinley, an editor of the News and Courier, tells of two of these showers of stones, which, according to him, undoubtedly fell. The localized repetitions of showers of stones are so much like the localized repetitions of showers of water, that one, inclusive explanation, or expression, is called for. Insects did them. Or the fishmonger of Worcester had moved to South Carolina. A complication has been developing. Little frogs fell upon Mr. Stoker and his horses, but we had no reason to think that either Mr. Stoker or his horses had anything to do with bringing about the precipitation. But the children of Clayvaz did seem to have something to do with showers of stones, and trees did seem to have something to do with the precipitations of water. Rand Daily Mail, May 29, 1922. That Mr. D. Neves, living near Rudeport, employed as a chemist in Johannesburg, having for several months endured showers of stones, had finally reported to the police. Five constables, having been sent to the place, after dark, had hardly taken positions around the house, when a stone crashed on the roof. Phenomena were thought to associate with the housemaid, a Hottentot girl. She was sent into the garden, and stones fell vertically around her. This is said to have been one of the most mysterious of the circumstances. Stones fell vertically, so that there was no tracing of them to an origin. Mr. Neves' home was an isolated building, except for outhouses. These outhouses were searched, but nothing to suspect was found. The stones continued to fall from an unknown source. Police Inspector Cummings took charge. He ordered all members of the family, servants, and newspaper men to remain in the house for a while, so everybody was under inspection. Outside were constables, and all around were open fields, with no means of concealment. Stones fell on the roof. Watched by the police, the Hottentot girl went to the well. A large stone fell near her. She ran back to the house, and a stone fell on the roof. It is said that everything that could be done was done, and that the cordon of police was complete. More stones fell. Convinced that in some way the girl was implicated, the inspector tied her hands. A stone fell on the roof. Then everything was explained. A civilian, concealed in one of the outhouses, had been caught throwing a stone. If so, whoever wrote this account did not mention the name of the culprit, and it is not said that the police made any trouble for him for having made them work. Then everything was explained again. It was said that the girl, Sarah, had been taken to the police station, where she had confessed. It is understood that Sarah admits being a party to all the stone throwing, and has implicated two other children and a grown native. So ends the Rudeport ghost story, shorn of all its alleged supernatural trappings. Though usually we do not think piously of the police, their stations are confessionals. But they're confessionals more in a scientific than in a religious sense. When a confessor holds a club over a conscience, he can bully statements with the success of any scientist who slugs data with a theory. There is much brutality in police stations and in laboratories, but I can't say that we're trying to reform anything, and if there never has been a Newton, or a Darwin, or an Einstein or a Moses, or a Christ, or a St. Augustine who has practiced other than the third degree upon circumstances, I fear me that sometimes we are not innocent of one or two degrees, ourselves. However, the story reads more as if the girl had been taken to a barber shop. Her story was shorn, we read. It was clipped bald of all details, such as the cordon of police, search of the outhouses, and the taking of precautions, such as will not fit in with this yarn of the tricky kids. In this book we shall note much shearing. The writer, in the Monthly Weather Review, is not the only clipper who forces a conviction, when he can. There was a case, in another part of South Africa, not long before the bombardments at Rudeport began. In the Klerksdorp Record, November 18, 1921, it is said that for several weeks there had been mysterious stone throwing by invisible agencies at the houses of Mr. Gibbon Joseph and Mr. H. J. Minar, in North Street. A detective was put upon the case. He was a logician. It was a ghost story, or it was a case of malicious mischief. He could not pinch a ghost. So he accused two Negroes, and arrested them. The Negroes were tried upon testimony given by two boys of their race. But the boys contradicted each other, and it was brought out that they were lying. They admitted that the logical detective had promised them 5 shillings to substantiate his syllogisms. In the Journal of the Society for Psychical Research, 12-260, is published a letter from Mr. W. G. Groton Dieck, telling that, about 1 o'clock, one morning in September, 1903, at Dordrecht, Sumatra, he was awakened by hearing something fall on the floor of his room. Sounds of falling objects went on. He found that little, black stones were falling, with uncanny slowness, from the ceiling, or the roof, which was made of large, overlapping, dried leaves. Mr. Groton Dieck writes that these stones were appearing near the inside of the roof, not puncturing the material, if through this material they were passing. He tried to catch them at the appearing point, but, though they moved with extraordinary slowness, they evaded him. There was a coolie boy, asleep in the house, at the time. The boy certainly did not do it, because at the time that I bent over him, while he was sleeping on the floor, there fell a couple of stones. There was no police station handy, and this story was not finished off with a neat and fashionable cut. I point out that these stories of flows of stones are not conventional stories, and are not well known. Their details are not standardized, like clanking chains in ghost stories, and eyes the size of saucers, in Sea Serpent Yarns. Somebody in France, in the year 1842, told of slow-moving stones, and somebody in Sumatra, in the year 1903, told of slow-moving stones. It would be strange if two liars should invent this circumstance. And that is where I get, when I reason. If strangeness be a standard for unfavorable judgment, I damn at a swipe most of this book. But damnation is nothing to me. I offer the data. Suit yourself. Nobody can investigate the reported phenomena that we're taking up, without noticing the number of cases in which boys and girls, but a great preponderance of girls, appear. An explanation by those who disregard a great deal or disregard normally is that youngsters are concerned so much, because it is their own mischief. Poltergeist phenomena, or teleportations of objects, in the home of Mr. Frost, 8 Farrowstone Road, Hornsey, London, for several months, early in the year 1921, cannot be so explained. There were three children. Phenomena so frightened one of them that, in a nervous breakdown, she died, London Daily Express, April 2, 1921. Another, in a similar condition, was taken to the Lewisham, London, hospital, London Daily News, April 30, 1921.